State versus Medina.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Cynthia Jones for the appellant, Mario Medina. Mr. Ramos is being represented by Tom Cumero of the Washington Appellate Project, and we have agreed to split our time today. Mr. Cumero would like 3 minutes to argue. I will take the sum of the time asking for 1 minute of rebuttal. The two issues
I want to make sure I got this because it's a little tricky. 3 minutes, you're going to start off with how many minutes?
So I would like to start off with 6 minutes, saving 1 minute for rebuttal.
Okay. So I'll put that on the clock, and then we'll work our way through.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm not good at higher math.
Thank you very much. The two issues that Mr. Medina brings on appeal is, one, whether the trial court abused its discretion when it allowed the prosecutor to amend the information 5 years after the arraignment, and two, whether Mr. Medina is entitled to credit for time served under CCAP.
Could you address the credit for time served issue first?
Sure, Your Honor. The essence of the state's argument is that Mr. Medina did not qualify for the program, therefore he's not entitled to credit. But you can look to guidance in both the State v. Swiger and State v. Anderson cases, where there the defendants were both violent offenders. They had been placed into programs under the SRA that were ineligible for violent offenders. And what the court said there is, the question before the court is not whether Swiger or Anderson, or is here Mr. Medina, was properly placed into the program. That fact has already passed. That's not the question before the court. Now the question is, did he serve time in that program, and is he entitled to credit? And the Constitution would say yes.
But there's a disagreement here about what law is applicable, as I understand it. And I guess we can have some agreement that the appropriate law that controls sentencing is the law in effect at the time of the crime, correct?
That would be true, Your Honor, but if we took the constitutional question as stated in Swiger v. Anderson, and if we were asking the court whether or not Mr. Medina was properly placed in the program, then we would be looking at that question of what law applies. I think the better reasoned argument is to look at, we're past that point of whether he was properly placed in the program or not. And even if we were to apply the law in effect at the time, then I think the court has to look at, if CCAP was not in effect at the time that Mr. Medina did his crime, although he was later placed into that program, then what we need to look at is the court's general jurisdiction to hold a defendant. And his liberty was restricted. He was placed in the program. He spent 4 years in the program.
Let me ask you some specifics. Sure. The record isn't real clear about exactly what he did. From what I've seen in the record, is it fair to say that he stayed in his residence and then did things during the daytime under the CCAP program?
That's true.
So it was his residence.
Yes.
It was not a jail facility, and obviously it was not prison.
True.
Okay.
That's
true. And what was the nature of what he did during the daytime?
I believe he had to spend, there. He was in flux in the program, and there were times in the program where he had to spend a substantial part of his day at a facility receiving certain kinds of classes.
When you say facility, what do you mean?
The King County facility, where they taught classes and gave, in other words, other kinds of instruction.
So you don't mean a jail facility?
No, not okay. A jail facility. However, I would point out that if the question was before the court of whether he was properly placed in the program, then we would be looking at status. We would be looking at a violent offender versus a nonviolent offender. That is not the question. The question is, what is the remedy for him spending 4 years in the program? Every other participant in CCAP gets credit for time served against any jail sentence. That is the same condition that Mr. Medina served, and that is along the lines of the reasoning of both State v. Swiger and State v. Anderson. And I will leave it there. There is an unpublished case that we're barred to talk about, but
correct.
Where that's
Can
been
I
found.
Ask a question?
Yes.
Was he sentenced as Was he ordered into CCAP as part of his sentence?
He was ordered into CCAP pre-trial, before the second trial occurred. And the state did not object at that time. They could have objected to him being part of CCAP.
So there was no adjudication then?
Exactly.
I'm clear about that.
True. It was a state-ordered, court-ordered program that he had no choice but to participate in. And I see my time is short. I would like to jump quickly to the first issue, if that's all right. And in the first issue, the state in its briefing relies solely on the James case, and we have laid out several grounds for distinguishing James, and I just want to focus in on one very quickly, and that is the policy and the reasoning that drove Justice Utter's decision there. He had a prosecutor who had amended the information with, quote, reasonable dispatch, which was about 18 days after arraignment. There was an ongoing investigation, and there was newly discovered evidence that justified the amendment of the information, where here the amendment occurs 5 years after the arraignment. There's no ongoing investigation. There's no newly discovered evidence. And in fact, Mr. Medina and his trial counsel relied on representations from the prosecutor on the record that he would not seek anything greater than first-degree manslaughter. And what we're asking the court is to find the specific prejudice of Mr. Medina relying to his detriment on the prosecutor's statements that he would not seek anything higher than first-degree manslaughter. And if there are no more questions from the panel, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, that'll be 4 minutes.
Actually,
total.
3 minutes to Mr. Comeroo,
oh,
and I think
now.
I get about a minute and 6 seconds.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were going to give Ms. Vitalich a chance to respond to both of our arguments. Thomas Comeroo appearing on behalf of Felipe Ramos. And as I pointed out, I'm going to speak for about 3 minutes. I think we've winnowed the issue down here. The state has arguably conceded that this was the incorrect instruction. The state has arguably conceded that defense counsel was deficient for proposing this instruction. So it all comes down to a question of either harmless error or prejudice. Can Mr. Ramos show prejudice from this incorrect instruction? You have to remember that there have been two trials. Mr. Ramos was acquitted of first-degree murder the first time. He was acquitted in this trial of first-degree intentional murder. It's pretty clear that Mr. Medina was the shooter. So it all comes down to a question of what did Mr. Ramos know? And that is a real question. And when you have an instruction like here, where the question is whether he knew of a substantial risk of a wrongful act by Mr. Medina versus a knowledge of a substantial risk of death, big difference. Clearly, these two men went to see Mr. Collins, confront Mr. Collins. But it's a question of whether Mr. Ramos knew that Mr. Medina was going to shoot and kill Mr. Collins. And I don't believe that the evidence shows that. And I think the jury was troubled by that, by acquitting Mr. Ramos in the first-degree murder and second-degree murder. And I think if the correct instruction was given here, I think he would have been acquitted of manslaughter as well.
In any event, you're saying it's a jury question for a remand.
Absolutely. It's a question of whether it's remanded for another trial with the correct instruction. Yes. So unless the court has any questions, I'm willing to give the rest of my time to Ms. Jones.
Okay.
Thank you. We would just ask that the court reverse and remand Mr. Ramos' case.
All right. Thank you. So that'll be 2 minutes for a rebuttal as I quickly use my mathematical. Yes.
Good morning. May it please the court. Andrea Vitalich from the King County Prosecutor's Office on behalf of the respondent, State of Washington.
Could you deal with the credit for time served issue? I think I understand your argument, but I just want to make
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Your Honor, the appellant Medina misapprehends the state's argument. I'm not arguing that he's not entitled for credit because he was categorically ineligible for the program. What I'm arguing is that the law in effect in 1997 when the defendants killed Mr. Collins does not support the notion that the legislature intends for violent offenders such as Mr. Medina to be given credit for CCAP. In addition, the current statute that categorically states that violent offenders like Mr. Medina are not at all entitled to credit for this kind of program is evidence of legislative intent.
That's certainly an argument, but even a narrow argument, as I understand, encompassed within your argument, is that he did not spend time in a facility during this period when he was under CCAP.
That's correct. The court has to...
And according to former 180 that you cite in your brief, that is a requirement of someone in, quote, partial confinement.
What I'm focusing in on as far as the law in 1987 is the definition of partial confinement, which you can find definitions of partial confinement in two different statutes. Both statutes state that partial confinement constitutes confinement in a facility or institution, and in one statute it says for a substantial portion of each day, and in the other statute it says for at least 8 hours per day. And the statute that defines CCAP as an alternative to confinement program in which an offender must participate for a minimum of 6 hours a day. And that's for what's known in King County as CCAP enhanced. As Your Honor noted, there are also substantial periods of time pre-trial where Mr. Medina was in something called CCAP basic, which only requires a daily phone call and no participation in any program for any period of time during the day. So obviously that's not even an issue as far as whether that constitutes partial confinement. So looking at the definition of partial confinement versus the definition of what the CCAP program is, it's my position that the plain language of the statutes in the SRA on one hand and the King County Code provision on the other demonstrates that CCAP does not meet the definition of partial confinement. A secondary argument, of course, is that the only clear legislative intent evidence that we have as to who is entitled to credit for CCAP is only nonviolent, non-sex offenders who receive sentences of a year or less. So that being additional evidence of legislative intent is certainly relevant to this court's analysis, but my primary argument is that the definition of partial confinement does not encompass a program like CCAP. CCAP's not a facility or institution. It's not confinement. It's an alternative to confinement. It's a program that requires participation by the offender.
Aren't there sanctions, though, if he doesn't comply with those conditions? And the second part of the question is, is the record fully developed as to what precisely it is he was sentenced to? Because CCAP has a lot of components.
The record, I've designated a bunch of supplemental clerk's papers that include the forms that are filled out when someone's ordered into CCAP, and the conditions are set forth in those papers. So the court can look to the clerk's papers to see what the requirements are. I would also disagree with...
But you don't disagree with the characterization that he was in a residence during this period of CCAP.
That's correct.
And he did something during the day.
And he went to this center where CCAP offers programs during the day. I would also disagree that the state did not object to the placement in CCAP. We objected to the release of the defendants or the reduction in bail that led to the release of the defendants. So I would disagree with that characterization as well.
So you would characterize it as simply a condition of release?
It's an alternative to confinement program.
Well, I know it's an alternative to confinement, but what is it? He's not serving a sentence. Are you saying it's a condition? Is it a condition of his release that he comply with this?
The court ordered him into CCAP after his release, so I suppose it could be characterized.
Well, did it order after his release, or did it order it at the time that it set bail?
It's my understanding, I would have to go back at the clerk's papers and look, but my recollection is that in the reduction in bail, one of the conditions of the reduction in bail was the participation in the CCAP program. So in that sense, it would be a condition of the, assuming the posting of bail, this is the condition that applies. And again, there was a lot of fluctuations over the course of the lengthy proceedings that took place prior to this trial as to whether the defendants were in CCAP basic or CCAP enhanced. And so that there are a number of clerk's papers I've designated that can show that progression. In regards to the amendment of the information, the crux of the analysis as to whether a trial court exercises sound discretion in allowing a pretrial amendment is whether the defendant can demonstrate substantial prejudice to a prejudice to a substantial right. So it's the defendant's burden to show that there's prejudice. All of the cases that analyze that issue focus on whether there is substantial prejudice to the defendant's right to prepare a defense at trial. There are no cases that hold that thinking that you could have pled guilty to a lesser charge prior to an amendment constitutes prejudice. And in fact, that's not a right of the defendant. There is no constitutional right to plead guilty. And in fact, there is a rule-based right to plead guilty, but only at arraignment. So therefore, once arraignment has passed, the defendant has no further right to plead guilty prior to any sort of amendment to a higher charge. Therefore, categorically, Mr. Medina can't show prejudice to a substantial right because there is no right at issue. The focus on the fact that there was 5 years intervening between the filing of the manslaughter charge and the filing of the second-degree murder charge is of no moment in this case because the delay in the amendment is directly attributable to the appellate proceedings that took place as a result of an interlocutory appeal that the defendants themselves initiated. And the fact that they obtained a result in the state Supreme Court that was not favorable does not constitute prejudice either. Turning to the question of instructional error that Mr. Ramos has raised, the question is here whether Mr. Ramos can meet his burden under Strickland of showing a reasonable probability that the jury verdict would have been different if a different instruction defining recklessness had been given. And in making that analysis, this court must look to the record and the evidence that was produced at trial and what it proved. What that evidence proved here was that both defendants had been drinking and were very angry with Mr. Collins for having sent Maria home.
That's true, but the issue really is knowledge.
The issue is knowledge as defined in the instructions, which is what it would a reasonable person in Mr. Ramos's position have understood to have been the risk. I would note that this is Mr. Ramos's gun. This is Mr. Ramos's ammunition. All of the additional supplies that the defendants brought with them to the confrontation with Mr. Collins belonged to Mr. Ramos. Mr. Ramos served several years in the military, had training in that respect, was an experienced gun owner. Maria testified that they went target shooting together, that assuming that Mr. Medina is the shooter, which is apparently what the second jury concluded, what we have here is Mr. Ramos supplying a loaded firearm and bringing additional supplies to a confrontation with the victim with whom the defendants are angry. Giving a loaded firearm to your friend who's been drinking for the purposes of confronting that victim. Any reasonable person, knowing what Mr. Ramos knew, standing in Mr. Ramos's shoes, certainly would have known that there was a substantial risk that Mr. Collins would end up dead, whether by some sort of accident or whether an intentional shooting as took place here. Any reasonable gun owner, knowing what Mr. Ramos knew, would have known of that substantial risk. And Mr. Ramos disregarded it. In this case, the evidence also showed Mr. Ramos was the driver. He parked the vehicle in a far corner of the parking lot, backed up next to a dumpster near an exit. That indicates an intent to flee the scene, which ultimately didn't happen because he dropped the key. But showing some knowledge as to what sort of confrontation was about to occur. In addition, while the defendants were at the apartment arming themselves before they went back to the motel, Mr. Ramos changed into black clothing, also evidencing some knowledge on his part as to what kind of confrontation they were going to have. Again,
I'm sorry, I don't understand why black clothing has anything to do with.
They went to confront the victim at night. Mr. Ramos changed into black clothing. I think that's a significant fact to the court, for the court to consider. And also the placement of the car in the parking lot indicates some knowledge on his part that this was not going to be any sort of friendly confrontation, but something they were going to have to flee from. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points. Back to the CCAP issue. If we're looking at the statutory scheme that was in effect at the time Mr. Medina committed the crime, and CCAP did not exist, then what this court can do is give Mr. Medina credit under the court's general authority to hold someone before trial. So Mr. Medina had not yet been tried. He had not yet been sentenced, yet he was court-ordered into a program meant for a program in lieu of sentence to be given credit for time served. It's a conundrum, and I think in the same way that Anderson had a conundrum where there was a Washington state statute that says, yes, this person can go on home detention. And the SRA said, no violent offender can go on home detention. What did they do? And again, they asked, well, what is the question before the court? It's not whether he was properly placed into the program. It's that he served the time. And the Constitution mandates that you will not get multiple punishments for the same crime. And so he must get credit for those 4 years served. Back to the amendment, 5 years after the arraignment, there is some guidance in a recent case, Missouri v. Fry, decided by the United States Supreme Court. And while it did not deal with amendment of information there, it did deal with plea negotiations and the importance of plea negotiations in our criminal justice system. And there it said the most critical point for a defendant is at the point of the plea. We have become not a system of trials, but a system of pleas. And at the point that Mr. Medina pled, the prosecutor put on the record that he would not seek anything higher than first-degree manslaughter. And as Missouri v. Fry pointed out, to cure any misunderstandings later, when a prosecutor puts intentions on the record, that is what we can go to for guidance of what the defendant understood. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is...